On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
There was a very momentous event that occurred in Pike County recently. That was the dedication of a historical marker in a ceremony honoring those who served in Pike County in the SCLC Scope Project of 1965. It was held at the Pike County Courthouse on January 13th. And the president of Scope 50, Reverend John Reynolds, a staff member of the SCLC starting in 1965 and is from Troy, Pike County. This is a rare opportunity that we have to talk to somebody face-to-face. This event was going to happen. Could we promote it? I said, absolutely. And I said, gee, did you write a book? And he said, yes, I did. He said, I'll drop you a copy. And I said, great, because I'd love to interview you. So that is how we came to be in this place, which is very exciting for me. I just to let you know, I did not grow up here, but I moved here and married a girl who grew up here and have been here ever since. I always kind of had a general idea of what it must have been like in Troy and South Alabama in the mid-1960s. But reading your book and the places that you went gives me so much more of a comprehensive idea of just what you guys faced as the organization, as a people, and the kind of things that happened. I've read lots of books about what went on in Birmingham and bigger places. But I think it's really important for us to know what happened right here for folks that live in and around Pike County, what was going on all those years ago. So we're really honored and privileged to have Reverend John Reynolds with us today, and I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
In 1965, you were 18 years old. You grew up living on essentially a sharecropping situation, and you refer to that as plantation living because there wasn't very much difference between what it was like to be on a plantation and what it was like to be a sharecropper.
Right.
That much I knew, but the situation that you found yourself in, and I can certainly understand this, all this Jim Crow nonsense had been going on decade after decade after decade, and everybody kept saying, be patient, be patient. It'll get better. It'll get better.
Yes.
And when you're an 18-year-old man, you are tired of waiting.
Yes.
And I get a sense of that from your book. And the name of his book, by the way, is The Fight for Freedom, A Memoir of My Years in the Civil Rights Movement by John Reynolds. And it's from Author House. And we'll talk about where people can find a copy of that.
Okay.
So tell us what it was like for you and how you came to be involved with the SCLC.
Okay. You were saying I grew up on a plantation, as I refer to it. My father was sharecropper, and my mother for the owner of the plantation. And I went work in the field when I turned 9, from sunrise to sunset, for $1.25 a day. But that was a way that I could help my mother put food on the table.
Right.
So basically, when September came, I went to school and registered on the first day. But in most cases, I didn't get back to school till November. Or if it rained, I could go
right
on the day that it rained. So that was sort of my situation, you know, how I grew up. And I also just need to say my grandmother never sat in a restaurant in Troy and had a meal. She loved barbecue. And there was a place out on 231, a barbecue place that she loved. But she had to go in the back on the outside and order through a window.
Yeah.
And so one of the things after I had left, one of the first things I did, I would go to this restaurant and sit from my mother.
Right.
Specifically how I got involved in SCOPE, Tuskegee Institute had a program that summer, and I was going to that. And I also had a janitorial job at Troy University, Troy State back then. And on this particular day that I was leaving the program from Tuskegee, I saw this young white man talking to a black woman, and I just noticed his body language.
Right.
You know, and so I took the chance and stopped and waited till he finished the conversation. And I approached him and asked him if he was a civil rights worker. Unfortunately for me, he said yes. And so that's how I got involved. While I was working at Troy University, I would go out with them to do canvassing
right.
and stuff like that. And you need to understand, it was difficult back then. My father, after he left the farm, got a job in construction. So, which was a good job.
Right.
Back then for him. And he was very fearful that he was going to lose his job because of my involvement.
Right.
And he beat me with a hole from a refrigerator. So that's when I start working full-time. The project director basic said, I will be your father then. And that's how I got involved.
And he really was for you, wasn't
he? He was.
He stayed involved in your life the rest of his life.
Right. He passed away a couple of years ago, and he was at all of the events, major events in my life. My wedding, when I graduated from college, when I graduated from seminary, he was there. When my wife and I adopted our daughters, you know, he was there. And a lot of those events, mm-hmm. my birth father was not present.
Right.
Although we had made a difference, but for a number of reasons, he couldn't come. One, because of his job.
Right.
You know, and he didn't have the money to do those things. So yeah. Leon was there yeah. at all of those yeah. occasions.
Now, you got involved in the SCOPE project was a voter registration project.
Yes.
From reading your book, I learned that the situation was that even though during this time, during this year, the Voter Rights Act passed the U.S. Congress, mm-hmm. but that did not mean that all of the probate judges or all of the local voter registrars
right.
suddenly changed their mind and right. said, oh, well, in that case, come on in. As a matter of fact, it was just business as usual in a lot of places,
yes.
wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, back then, there were still literacy tests that people had to pass the literacy test. And the poll tax was also in play. And so one of the thing was that even teachers couldn't pass the literacy test.
Right, because they'd ask questions like, well, tell us the preamble to the Constitution
yes.
and the ten amendments in the Bill of Rights
yeah.
and in order and word for word.
Yes.
Yeah, like yeah. like most people in America couldn't have passed that test.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
and most of you know people who work out in the fields and stuff didn't know how to read and write.
Right.
So it was much more difficult. For those folks. And the local leader here was Mrs. Johnny Mae Warren, a really wonderful
yes.
Woman.
It was my privilege to know her.
Got to know a good woman.
Yeah.
And so she housed us and found places for all of the people to stay. And you need to know, 98% of those was white volunteers from colleges across the country. Leon Guthus, who was the project director,
mm-hmm.
was a history teacher in White Plain, New York. And so one of the problems back then was that people was hassled if they let SCOPE workers stay in their place.
Right.
Like Miss Baker. I mean, he was threatened and Yeah. And several other people was threatened.
Sure. It put you on the radar of the police who often were, shall we say, maintaining the narrative.
Right. And that's the point. Back then, the city had just hired two or three black to be policemen, but they could only function in the black community.
Right.
They couldn't arrest or talk to anybody who was white.
Right.
And so that was also one of the problems that they would go out, intimidate these folks
right.
on behalf.
Right.
But.
I was pleased to see that the probate judge in those days, Ben Reeves, seemed to be, at some point, became a little more amenable.
Right.
But it meant in a lot of places, it meant calling in the Fed so they would bring in federal registrars,
right.
and that's what it took in a lot of places.
Right. Judge Reed, he, in today's vernacular, he was the man. It's important that I think that people need to know what he did. His whole thing was that he was not going to allow Troy and Pike County become another Selma or Lowndes County.
Right.
That was his whole thing. And he lived up to that. Back then, you had one day, a month to register.
Right.
And he got the days increased, you know, by calling the state and saying, we need more and more days.
Right.
He personally called Judge Johnson.
Oh, okay. And Frank Johnson was a great ally for the movement as well.
Right. And he was the one who ruled that Pike County could no longer use the literature test in the poll tax.
And now, I would think, you know, in retrospect, well, then they must have quit immediately. But unfortunately, that was not necessarily the case.
No. Judge Reed, he was on the case.
Yeah.
And the registrar back then, he looked up to Judge Reed, you know. So if Judge Reed made suggestions and stuff,
He would take that.
He would do it. And, you know, Judge Reed was a good person in general.
Right.
You need to understand that he was also a businessman.
Right.
At the time. He owned a men's dressing store.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He also owned a food store.
Oh, okay.
And stuff. Right. He pretty much everything on the right side of the square on Love Street and the Rock Building.
Right, right.
That he pretty much owned.
Okay.
And so Black sort of got to know him in those transactions.
Okay.
And a lot of people felt that he was fair.
Yeah.
But he was good, man. He would go home, and at night he hear stuff. He would go out after dinner,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I can't give him enough credit for, I think, making the difference and saving a lot of pain for both communities.
Right. And there were a lot of places that you went, and you got sent all over Alabama
mm-hmm.
because the SCLC knew that you were an Alabamian, and therefore you would be seen as an outsider, but not so far outside.
Right.
But you went to some places that were pretty scary. I think it was Greene County.
Yeah.
That was maybe one of the scariest places.
Yeah. Lowndes County.
Right.
Yeah. And I worked all over. And my first assignment they sent me back here.
Yes.
To Troy to help people learn how to read and write and just try to keep the momentum going. And one of the things that I mentioned in my book, some years later, George Reed says, you know, if people knew that you was from Troy, they would have killed you.
Yeah.
And I said, yes, Your Honor. I know. And it was fortunate for me, I just had bought a 56 Chevy, and it had Florida license plates.
Ah.
So when people saw me, they just assumed
that you were from Florida.
From Florida. And so that and was when I...
being an outsider, being a, and I'll use the word that they used, an agitator.
Right.
Right. Or a northern agitator. That was the one they liked, too. Well, it's okay. Because, you know, we don't expect any better from him because he came here to stir up trouble.
Right, right.
That was the way it would have been said.
That was the language.
Yeah.
And, you know, and... I was fortunate that my first arrest was made here. We was going out to bank.
Uh-huh.
We tried to set up a meeting
at
a church out there. And I had an accident that I slid through a stop sign.
Right, right.
And so that was my first arrest.
Yeah, but the thing is, because it sounds worse than it was. You had to leave the car there. You couldn't get it going.
Right.
And so you had to walk to the event.
Yeah.
And then when you came back, they arrested you for leaving the scene of an accident.
Right.
A one-car accident with your car.
Right.
That was, nobody was hurt.
Yeah.
Not even you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And fine, $25,
yes.
I believe.
Yes. I thought, amazing. What a nerve.
Yeah.
But there were times that you were pretty much in mortal peril. There were times that you were beaten by police as part of it, as demonstrations and so forth.
Yes.
But because of the nonviolent attitude of Dr. King and Dr. Abernathy's organization, the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, because of that, you guys were trained, and I've seen movies about this. So when I saw them, I thought, what would I think as an 18-year-old if they had to practice beating on you so you get used to it, so you would go, oh, okay, well, I can survive this and not fight back.
Right.
Because that would be the hardest thing.
That was the thing. When Dr. King interviewed me, and a woman by the name of Cecil Clark insisted that he interview me rather than I'm going through the normal process.
Right, right.
Because I was sort of shy, you know, this country boy.
Right, right.
But she felt that I had, you know, something. And the two questions that stood out to me, are you willing to accept nonviolence? And are you willing to die for the cause? On the first one, I hesitated, but answer yes on the second right away. He said that you're hired, but you have to read at least two books by Gandhi on nonviolent. And the point that you make, it's important that people to understand you needed to do that role play.
Right.
You know, being beaten and you know, tackling, you know, and stuff because... One, you wanted to try to protect yourself as much as you could. And so you couldn't react to everything that happened to you. And so you practice being beaten and you learn how to protect the most important body parts.
Right, right.
You know?
And, yeah.
You know, stuff like that. And one of the things that people don't understand is that we sort of wore blue jeans and denim outfit.
Yeah, the freedom suit you referred to.
Right, yeah, exactly, freedom suit. But they was used for other purpose. They protect you because denim is thicker than the shirt that you have on now.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a part of...
Gave you a little more layering, a little more cushioning.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
You know,
gotcha.
So you know, you learn those kinds of things. And
they were going to arrest you, too. And so
right.
If you're in a silk suit or something when you get arrested, imagine what it's going to look like after a couple of weeks in jail. Denim holds up.
Yeah. It was very important. Because the other thing that we was trained for is to learn how to protect other folks.
Right.
You know, if people was marching, I was responsible for a certain number of people.
Right, right.
You know?
You guys, I remember reading that in several places, when you did demonstrations that y'all flanked them so that you were kind of a squad leader, in effect.
Yes.
Those are your people. They're your responsibility.
Exactly.
And this kind of thing, I know we could talk for a couple of hours about this, and I wish we had the time.
Yeah,
but
I understand.
But when there was a particular time that, and this was really powerful to me, it was after Dr. King was murdered. And the organization had planned the special event to unite poor people regardless of their ethnicity or race or anything.
Yes.
And it was going to go on in Washington, and y'all were determined to make sure that it did happen.
Yeah.
That it wouldn't stop just because of his, we didn't want to let the bad guys win, right?
Yes.
And your job at that place became, you were the guy in charge of sanitation, which no small thing for the Freedom City.
Yeah.
No small thing when you have thousands of people living in a small area.
Yeah.
You need somebody to pick up the garbage because the minute you didn't, that would have been something. They would have had an excuse to go after
you. Exactly.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it rained a lot during that time, so people was living in mud.
Yeah.
So there was health issues.
Right.
You know.
Right.
You know, because of that, and you know, and that was my job. You know, and I did the best I could.
yeah. And you mentioned some of the famous people that were allies of yours that you became friends with. Joan Baez does not surprise me at all. I've read a lot about her involvement in the movement. But you mentioned in that particular situation somebody, and I was really pleased because I always kind of had the feeling he was that kind of guy. Robert Culp.
Yeah.
Because he co-starred with Bill Cosby. And insisted that they get equal billing.
Exactly. He picked up garbage for 2 weeks, man. That just amazed me.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right. I mean, Joan was there. His biggest steward. He was there the whole time.
Right.
And he played music, you know, at night and stuff for everybody. Arthur Kitt was there, you know, people like that.
Harry Belafonte,
yes,
big supporter.
Yes, Harry was always there. For everything. It was a time.
Yeah, an extraordinary time, I think. Yeah. When for the first time you see hope, no matter how painful the journey is going to be, you see a chance to really make a systemic change.
Right.
And I will say to you, and I've had this chance to share this with other people too, that I was a little kid. I was 10 in 1963, and I can remember seeing and living in Daytona Beach, Florida, when we thought we were so progressive, and it's turned out we weren't. But we were under the illusion that we're not Alabama. You know?
Right.
I remember seeing on television little kids my age getting hit by fire hoses and police dogs.
Yeah.
And I was a paper boy. I knew what it meant to get bitten by a German Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
And I was astounded, and I asked my parents what was going on, and they had no answer.
Yeah.
So it did touch hearts and minds. It did expose people who never would have thought about it because otherwise, I mean, for a white kid who never knew a black kid, this is a way to say to them, this is what's going on in your country.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention just one other name. Elizabeth Stanberg is one of the people that's going to be on the marker.
Okay.
She was a 16-year-old white girl from Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay.
Who worked here at one of the volunteers as well. And her kids, we We had to move her in and out because we didn't want people to be able to target her and know who she was. Yeah, so she would come for 3 days or something, then we'd send her to another county, bring her back, and that kind of stuff.
Was she the girl that was in the trunk in that story?
That was another woman, but yeah. So Elizabeth Stenberg, and she became a nurse and still lives in Birmingham.
How about that?
I was hoping to get her down here, but I was unable to reach her.
We are so glad that this monument is going up. By the time this interview airs, it will already be up, and people can go by the Pike County Courthouse and see it for themselves.
Yes.
And I'm so glad that you came back to your old hometown to be a part of this.
Yes.
And the people that you have known and the things that you have seen make an extraordinary story.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And when you're from a place, people don't give you credit. You know, because you're just one of them.
Right,
you
right.
Know?
Yeah.
And so they don't always understand, you know, what you did and what you accomplished and, you know, stuff like that. But
well, it's been a great honor to get
Thank
to
you.
Know you. I'm
Same
so
here.
Glad that you came here
Thank
and
you.
That this is going to happen. And I'm so glad that I had a chance to read your book.
Thank you very much.
It is an extraordinary read. And can people find it on Amazon or
yeah, they can get it at Amazon, Barnes and Nobles. You can still get it.
This will be a great book to have at the Barnes and Noble at the Troy University camp. There would be plenty of my students who would be amazed to read these stories.
It was there.
Oh, okay.
When it first came out.
Oh, okay.
And I did a book sign in there and
well,
everything.
Very cool. I'm sorry I missed that. I was around here. I don't know why I didn't hear about it. But I'm so glad that we got a chance to talk.
Same here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Our thanks once again for Reverend John Reynolds joining us on the bookshelf today. Be sure to look for his book, Fight for Freedom. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.